The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. In February 2016, Jose Oliva, a veteran of the Vietnam War and 30 years in law enforcement, went to a routine dental appointment at the El Paso VA. He did nothing wrong and certainly nothing illegal, but he ended up on the ground in a chokehold facing federal charges. On today's show, I'm going to talk with IJ attorneys Patrick Giacomo and Alexa Gervasi about what happened and how Jose is trying to vindicate his rights. Alexa, before we talk about that day in 2016, could you give a quick nutshell of Jose's background and his time in law enforcement?
Yeah, absolutely. Jose Oliva, who is now 75 years old, is a hero by any definition. He joined the military right out of high school to fight in the Vietnam War during the deadliest years of the war. Though he was only an enlisted soldier, he led a group of a dozen men, and he led them all home safely. After returning from the war, he joined the federal law enforcement, where he served for 30 years. And by the end of his career, to commemorate his time in law enforcement, he was given this beautiful gold watch as this thank you. And he left law enforcement to go and take care of his 7 grandchildren, which is what he does now.
So February 2016, he goes to the VA. Can you describe, Patrick, what happened that day?
Yeah, sure. So Jose was headed to his local VA for a routine dental appointment. He'd obviously been to this particular VA on many occasions, and this VA has a security checkpoint at the entrance. So there is an X-ray machine and a metal detector that you go through. And so, as he had many times before, Jose placed his belongings in the bin to be X-rayed and then was waiting in line to go through the metal detector when one of the police, who are federal officers working at the VA hospital as security, asked him for his identification. And Jose explained his identification was in the bin, as it normally would be. And for some reason, this really upset the police officer, who then aggressively came all the way around the checkpoint, pulled out his handcuffs, and pointed for Jose to go through the metal detector, which he did. And as he did so, another officer grabbed him from the front, and the first officer put him in a chokehold immediately, slammed him to the ground, wrenched his arms behind his back, and put him in handcuffs and led him away. This has all been captured on video, and the video shows exactly what happened, how quickly it happened. The officers never offered any explanation for why they did what they did, except they said in affidavits later filed with the court, all of which were identical, that they had to do this because Jose, a 70-year-old man who was going to a dental appointment at his local hospital, had tried to get past security without being cleared first. And if you watch the video, it's very clear that's not what happened at all, because Jose went through the metal detector when the officers pointed him to do so. And then as he was going through the metal detector is when they set themselves upon him, put him in the chokehold, and threw him to the ground.
So 70-year-old man thrown to the ground. What were the consequences of that for him? I mean, was that physically, was he physically harmed?
Absolutely. I mean, again, he was 7 years old and tackled to the ground by 3 young officers. And since that incident, he's had 2 shoulder surgeries, been told he'll never regain full use of his shoulder. He was choked so violently that he has lasting throat and ear problems. You know, the ironic thing here is that he spent 3 years in a deadly war and suffered greater injuries from trying to visit the dentist at the VA.
And what happened to the officers? Were there consequences for them at all?
No, not. I mean, they opened an investigation. The FBI opened an investigation, and then it just went away. Nothing ever came of it. Similarly, Jose was charged with disorderly conduct, but as you saw in the video, you know, he didn't do anything disorderly, so those charges also went away.
So the security officers at the VA are federal officers, and that's why this went to the FBI. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And then when nothing happened, what was Jose's response to that? Why, I guess, just did he just write it off and decide, like, this, it just really sucks. Like, no, there's nothing to be done now. You know, the system just failed me. Or what was his decision making process after that?
No. So as Alexa mentioned, Jose had been involved in the FBI's investigation of these officers. And as a law enforcement officer himself, he took a great amount of offense to the way that these particular officers had behaved because it was offensive to him as a career law enforcement officer. And Jose was very frustrated when the local prosecutors, the federal prosecutors, decided not to move forward with any sort of charges against these officers. And at that point, we realize it really highlights the importance of the ability to bring a civil action against government officials, because otherwise, when the prosecutor decided not to go forward with charges against these officers, nothing would have happened. And so at that point, Jose filed a civil rights lawsuit against the officers. And at this point, it's useful to pause, because when you bring a civil rights lawsuit against government actors who violate your constitutional rights in a single instance in the past, you can't ask for an injunction or declaratory judgment where a court just says, you know, they can't do that anymore, or they shouldn't have done that, that's unconstitutional. The only thing that a plaintiff can do is bring a damages action that attaches some amount of monetary liability to the officers to hold them accountable. And so even though money's in play, Jose brought this lawsuit because he was offended by the behavior of the officers, which obviously did injure him. And he wanted to vindicate his constitutional rights and make sure that officers like these men can't do what they did to him to other people. And so that was the basis of the federal lawsuit that Jose filed against these officers.
That's interesting, because I think that it's easy to see a lawsuit brought against federal officers asking for money as perhaps even partially opportunistic, but that doesn't have to be the case at all. In fact, it's the only option available.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's something that's easily lost in the discourse, because the number of dollars always gets the headline, but there's no request for a specific amount of money. In Jose's case, Jose didn't file this lawsuit because he wanted money. He filed this lawsuit because there's absolutely nothing else anyone can do when their rights are violated in this manner if the prosecutor doesn't move forward with criminal charges. And even if they do, what the prosecutor is doing in that situation isn't vindicating the Constitution. It's vindicating some criminal law that these officers may or may not have violated. So if you want to hold officers accountable for violating your Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures, the only way to do it is to bring a damages suit, which is what Jose did in this instance.
And that in itself seems like for most people would be pretty costly, right? So did Jose have to find someone who he could afford, or someone who would take him on for free? How was that part of the experience for him?
Yeah, absolutely. That's always the first and sort of unseen step in these civil rights lawsuits, is you have to find a lawyer who's either willing to represent you for free or on a contingency basis, or in the rarest of instances that you can pay on an hourly basis. And you don't see those cases very often at all, because these cases always take so much time and so much effort that it's always a losing proposition to try to pay by the hour to find a lawyer to bring one of these lawsuits. And so here, Jose did retain an attorney. I'm not familiar with the relationship as far as whether it's contingency fee or pro bono. But at this point, well, you know, obviously Jose is represented by the Institute for Justice, and everything we do is pro bono.
So he found his attorney, brought the suit, and this happened in El Paso. So he's filing suit in Texas. How did it go?
Yeah, so he filed his civil rights lawsuit in the district court in Texas, and ultimately these officers moved for a summary judgment, saying the court should enter judgment in our favor on the basis of the doctrine of qualified immunity, which is probably the most common technique that government officials are able to use to get out of accountability for constitutional violations. And remarkably, in this instance, the district court did not grant the officers qualified immunity. It held that the law was clear in the Fifth Circuit in Texas that you cannot use this type of force on a non-resisting suspect who had not even committed a crime, which is how the court viewed Jose in this situation. And so it said the case could go forward against these officers. At the same time, the United States of America is actually a party to this case because of claims under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And the United States hasn't done much yet in the case except to argue, by answering the lawsuit, that Jose assumed the risk of getting beaten when he entered his local VA hospital, which I don't think any American expects that our VA hospitals are treating our veterans in that way.
No, that's insane. So he prevailed, right? So but you mentioned now that IJ is his attorney. So there's obviously a twist in the story. What happened?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're foreshadowing what's about to happen now because the officers appealed the qualified immunity ruling to the Fifth Circuit, which is the appellate court that sits over Texas. It's the court right below the U.S. Supreme Court. And the officers said we were entitled to qualified immunity. But alternatively, there is no claim here because since we're federal agents, this person, Jose, can't even sue us when we violate the Constitution. And the Fifth Circuit said, you know what? Even though that wasn't the argument that was made in the district court, you're right about that. We are going to interpret the law in such a way that says, because you guys are federal police, you can't be sued at all for violating the Constitution. And we don't even have to reach the issue of qualified immunity because, in effect, you're absolutely immune from suit because no one, Jose or otherwise, can sue you since you're federal actors.
So we alluded to the challenges of bringing lawsuits against government workers a couple of times, the cost being one, the fact that you have to be asking for damages. And I'd like to step back a little bit and talk about the legal posture of somebody who is in Jose's situation, where you've clearly suffered a wrong, done absolutely nothing, you know, to warrant it, and are seeking a path forward. What does the law look like for that person? What are the questions that they need to ask? What can they do as they look at the landscape and chart sort of a course toward justice?
Yeah, so what they can do is their best, because ultimately, from the starting position of a plaintiff whose constitutional rights have been violated, what they're looking at is a twisted game of chutes and ladders. And you sort of move forward on the board and hope that you don't end up on a chute that sends you back to the beginning by throwing your case out. And so the first question that always is presented is whether the people who violated your constitutional rights work for the federal government or whether they work for state or local governments. If it's a state or local case, you have a cause of action, at least. You are able to bring a lawsuit for a constitutional violation because there's a statute called Section 1983 that specifically permits it. But if you're someone like Jose, whose rights are violated by federal workers, you already are in a much murkier position because the cause of action, your ability to bring a lawsuit, is dependent on a Supreme Court case from the 1970s called Bivens, where the court implied that if the Constitution says you have a right, the court will grant you a constitutional remedy. And that is a very restrictive doctrine on its own. It only allows for three contexts, three specific situations where you can sue federal actors. So right now, there are already enormous holes in the ability to sue a federal actor. For example, if any federal actor you can imagine, violates your First Amendment rights, your religious rights, your freedom of speech rights, you have no constitutional cause of action against them. You can do nothing about it in the federal courts. Luckily for someone like Jose, one of the three contexts where you can bring a cause of action through Bivens, where you can sue a federal actor, is if it involves police violating your Fourth Amendment rights, your search and seizure rights. And so in Jose's case, that is the course that he charted. And he brought those constitutional claims under Bivens. The Fifth Circuit, however, has now drawn the finest of lines and said, because this case is factually distinguishable on the most minute details from that original case from the 1970s, we're not going to allow Jose to have a cause of action or to be able to sue these officers, even if they violated his constitutional rights and even if they're not entitled to qualified immunity, as the district court held below.
Clearly, getting into court is itself a huge barrier to accountability. Alexa, can you talk a little bit about how, even if people are able to navigate the chutes and ladders that Patrick was describing, did the best they can, charted a course, how they can still run up against procedural roadblocks that have nothing to do with the right or wrong of their case?
Yeah, absolutely. As Patrick mentioned, it's just incredibly difficult to even make it into court. And the scales really do, they start leaning in the government's favor. So let's assume that a federal officer has violated your constitutional rights and it happens to fit in one of these three very narrow areas where you actually can bring suit against a federal officer to hold the federal officer accountable for violating your constitutional rights, you still have to get over all of these different paths of immunity that federal officers have. One that we mentioned is qualified immunity, which says that unless the law is clearly established that there's a violation here, you don't get to bring suit. And so one thing that's important about qualified immunity is it's not immunity from liability. It's not just immunity from being held accountable. It's immunity from suit altogether. So you don't get to even engage in discovery or talk about in before the court what's happened. The doors to the court are just closed to you. And courts have just been very hesitant to hold officers accountable when this defense of qualified immunity is brought forward, once you're even past this really difficult first step of finding a federal cause of action that you can even raise.
And then obviously there are other kinds of immunities that the absolute immunity, the other opportunities to where you can't even bring cases against certain types of people in certain kinds of positions. And then, Patrick, you also mentioned the Bivens just sort of narrowing down. Given all of that, how are people ever successful in trying to hold government officials accountable? I mean, it seems that it's so clearly stacked against a person going into court to try to do that nobody could ever prevail.
Yes. Yeah, so the way that these doctrines are written, they're extremely restrictive. But ultimately, the standards that apply essentially mean that the ability to bring a Bivens action against a federal agent or the ability to prevail against qualified immunity have become sort of a matter of judicial grace, where if you happen to get the right judge or panel of judges, they will find a way for you to thread the needle and get through that. But if you don't, or if the courts apply these standards in a more strict way, it's impossible to bring the cases at all, let alone win them. And so if you look at something like the Fifth Circuit's decision, which departs from the Supreme Court precedent on how Bivens applies, what happens is you no longer have a uniform application of the law. So thanks to the way the system's set up, there's already two tracks of accountability, one for federal officers and one for state officers. But now even within Bivens itself, it depends where you are in the country, whether you actually have Fourth Amendment rights against federal officers. And so for people in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, which are the three states over which the Fifth Circuit sits, you basically have no Fourth Amendment rights against federal officers if they violate your search and seizure rights under the Fourth Amendment. And so that means that for those 36 million people and the 10,000 or so federal officers who police them at various agencies, there's no guidance on what can be done if someone violates your constitutional rights, and you're kind of just out of luck at this point.
Yeah, so that's, it's hard to imagine it being even worse, and for them it is even worse. So back to Jose, the Fifth Circuit pretty decisively tried to put an end to his case. IJ stepped in, filed cert for cert at the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you talk about what will happen if the court takes the case, or what the potential is for Jose if they take the case, and alternatively, what his position is if they don't?
Yeah, so just as a quick primer, the Bivens case involved a situation where agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which no longer exists, entered into a man's home and handcuffed him in front of his family before taking him to a federal courthouse and strip searching him. And so that was the context in which the Supreme Court said you can bring Fourth Amendment claims against federal actors. In recent years, the court has said more or less, we're not going to create any new situations where you can sue federal actors, but the traditional ways are still available. And so most of the circuit courts following that decision in 2017 have said, okay, there is a constitutional cause of action. You can sue federal agents when they violate your rights under the Fourth Amendment if they're essentially doing federal police work in a standard way. And so it doesn't matter what agency they're working with or what exactly they're doing or exactly how they violate your constitutional rights. If it's standard law enforcement operations, for example, the Fourth and Sixth Circuits have very clearly said there's a cause of action. So we don't care that in Bivens there was a Federal Bureau of Narcotics versus U.S. Parks Police versus U.S. Marshals or any of the other agencies. All we care about is the policing aspect and the fact that your Fourth Amendment rights are violated. Well, now the Fifth Circuit has broken from that consensus and now is essentially saying, if your case doesn't look exactly like the facts of Bivens, if you weren't involved in a narcotics investigation, essentially, in a very strange way, saying the only way you have any constitutional rights against federal officers in Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana is if you're suspected of selling drugs. It has created this crazy rift now, and that has a very broad application to all the people of Texas. But it's also obviously in this case, which involves the VA hospital, you know, that this puts 10% of American veterans at risk anytime they enter one of the 154 facilities in the Fifth Circuit that the VA provides. And so if the Supreme Court takes this case, our hope is that they will side back with the consensus, which we think is consistent with their earlier opinion, and say, no, regardless of our criticism of the Bivens doctrine and extending it, it exists in the context of federal policing writ large anytime there's a Fourth Amendment violation. If the court doesn't do that, what will happen is that all of the people in Mississippi, Texas, and Louisiana will have a different constitution in effect than the people across the rest of the country. And the concern is that maybe other circuits will follow the Fifth Circuit and broaden the split, thereby denying those rights to even more people. And so your Fourth Amendment rights will depend on whether you're in Michigan or Mississippi or Tennessee or Texas.
Thank you both for being here. Thank you to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can find more wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe.